who just need a little bit of updating. Remember, the Honourable and MRC did speak to and respond to the earlier submission. These are submissions subsequent to that. I think you're familiar with that yourself, Mr. Cortana, from the DTI. You yourself have been briefed in that regard. And also from BARTA, which you see coming up faintly. But CBA, the Western Cape, which we have. So we start with number 30, okay, the NDMA, moving to the DC, ECG, and I think there's just one more, the MKL. Are we right? Those are the last. Thank you. Over to you, Honourable Ambrosini.
Thank you, Madam Chairman. I have consolidated all the comments and the related responses in a single document, building the one previously submitted. So the document before you will have from number 1 to number 30, the submissions we received previously, we considered previously. The new submissions start from item number 30 to be found on page 4 in the middle of the row. And I will take, with your permission, the first omission from the NDMA, which is an acronym for National Data. Can't quite read it. Data Mediation Association. This is a group which seeks to find a mediation agreement between the creditor and the debtor, so that what is brought before the magistrate is a consolidated consensus proposal. I have captured its comment in my submission. What I have not captured, which I think it's important for members to know, are the figures that this submission gives us. They indicate that in a 20-month period, they processed 48,483 applications. I mean, this is the first figure that we can struggle with, that we can deal with, and tells you how many people are affected by the legislation before you. These are only those who, for whatever reason, chose to utilize their services. So they are obviously a percentage, probably less than half of the percentage of those who are actually under debt restructuring. So we're dealing with hundreds of thousands of people potentially affected by the legislation before you all. The first point that they raise, which is a point common to other submissions you heard before, is that the bill before you is a small problem. It's a small solution to a much, much bigger problem. It's a partial solution, and as they capture it, it's little more than a tweaking to a fundamentally flawed process. And the answer is that one concedes to that. And that the Parliament should wait for the end of the policy review by the DTI before fixing this specific problem, so you do a holistic approach. The answer, as discussed in previous occasions, is that we received a status of the policy review from the DTI. The policy review is the outcome has not yet been tabled in Cabinet. If once it's tabled in Cabinet, we will receive Cabinet mandate to begin drafting legislation. Once the legislation is drafted, it will need to be circulated, and then canvassed with all stakeholders and role players, and then only at that point tabled in Parliament before the committee. So it's going to be a process for which there is today no set time frame, and only depends on Cabinet approval and the actual getting around doing things and depending on the comments of shareholders or stakeholders. It's an immensely complex process because it's an immensely complex bill, and it's an immensely there are many things that many people want, so it's going to be time consuming. The issue before you all is, should Parliament not do something now that it can do once the bill is before you and the opportunity of, has been put before, putting a band-aid on a wound before the body goes into intensive care. And the submission is that Parliament should not pass on the opportunity of doing something good because the bill is before you and either you approve or you reject it. And that's the first one. Then on the second comment of 31, the NDMA agrees with the definition of consumer difficulties. And you will remember similar submissions, but it draws the conclusion that somehow those difficulties are addressed because the juristic persons are taken out. Now, this is not what the bill does. It doesn't deal with juristic persons. It deals with transactions. It wants to take out those transactions which are business to business, in which a business doesn't buy to consume, but it buys to own sell. So if a business buys 10 pencils to use them in the business, it's a consumer. If it buys them in bulk to sell them retail, it's not a consumer. And these latter transactions, when tied to an incidental credit agreement, the manufacturer gives them money to buy the products, are covered by the Act. And we heard it from DPI, we heard it from everybody that that was not the intention. So the exclusion of juristic persons doesn't address that, because juristic persons are excluded only for purposes of certain chapters and not chapters, and they continue to be bound by the National Credit Act in debt with regard incidental credit agreements. Then on the second proposal of this bill, the NDMA obviously conscious of its own business and role calls to change focus, to make a resolution by consensus the rule. And they make the point that what the bill does is often achieved by the parties agreeing to it within a process of mediation which leads to a consensus decision. Which is all right. Which is all fine. But what about when consensus cannot be reached? And sure, it's beyond the purpose of this bill to force people to reach consensus. And reaching consensus is something legally impossible because each person would have a veto power unless it becomes an arbitration where somebody decides. But what is interesting is that they recognize that what this bill is suggested, basically the elimination of interest, is one of the components in which they achieve consensus within the mediation process. So from the NDMA, I think that there is support for both notions under the proviso of wanting a much general reconsideration of the entire legislation. Then there's a submission from the debt counseling, which is, debt counselors, I think it speaks for itself, are the people who help the debtor restructure its debt and bring it to the court for approval. They too say there are big problems with the entire act, fix them all, but it goes to the point that we raised before. In respect to the first clause of the bill that supported, I don't think that I need to comment or respond because I agree with what they said out there. In respect of the second clause, they support it as well, but they state it is imperative to the objective of the act and to achieve this type of thing. Because the act wants to create a compromise between the two parties. It wants to give the tools to the court and the debt restructuring process to create a common ground which makes it possible for the debtor to carry his burden. So part of what it is stretching the period over which the debtor can pay. So giving the debtor, giving her a break for in respect of the payment of interest is part of enabling the debtor to carry her burden. And then they recognize that it is within the object of the act. But they add, the word must be unambiguous. But they don't indicate how this wording would be ambiguous. Then we move to the transaction capital group. And they welcome the amendment in clause 1, the business-to-business transaction. And so that doesn't require a response. And on clause 2, they say, clause 2 will adversely affect credit provider and consequently consumer. Clause 2 stops the accrual of interest. So the credit provider, the bank, the person who gave the money is going to lose something. People are suffering under their debt, and we are getting them to pay less, so the guy at the other side receives less. And they make the point that by guy on the other side receiving less, it will have an effect on the credit provider, which is twofold. It will increase the risk profile, which means that less people will get credit, and will transfer the cost that somebody needs to absorb of people who don't pay onto those who pay, possibly increasing the interest rate of the fees which are applied on all other loans. Now, this is true, but what this fails to understand is the alternative. The greatest impact on the credit provider is when one goes to insolvency. And what this act is meant to do is to avoid the number of insolvencies, because then the credit provider gets nothing. You get 10 cents on the rand, 15 cents on the rand. So by diminishing the insolvencies, one increases the potential of the act to decrease the cost on credit providers to deal with situations where the debt cannot carry its burden. And this is an additional tool to avoid people, especially at times of recession, to use the options available to them to go into insolvency. So somehow, if one considers the aspect, the concern is addressed, and credit providers should take this as a benefit rather than a damage. The other point that they raise, and here I'm alerting advocates from the Merve, is they say, well, that's unconstitutional, you can't take it away. There is a property clause, because he owes me money, he owes me interest, and he accounts the law and tells him that under certain conditions, a judge can order that he no longer owes me money. Now, one doesn't need to discuss this at great length, because the same point has been raised time and again with respect of bankruptcy. Insolvency. There is much easier because the institution has been around since the Middle Age. Bankruptcy was the breaking of the bank, the breaking of the table of the merchant, which denoted its insolvency in the Middle Age marketplace. But there the constitutional adjudication has indicated that the law has this power of eliminating a validly contracted debt, because the imperative of commerce and trade, the need of enabling people to get on with their life, is a countervailing element and falls within the limitation clause and falls within the other constitutional protected values. And surely, if it is allowed in respect of bankruptcy, insolvency, this is a much lesser measure, because it doesn't distinguish the principal debt as insolvency does, but only the accrual of interest for a limited period of time. The next comment is say, fine, you are giving the magistrate the power to decide when it's meritorious, where they can stop the accrual of interest up to 5 years, not for the entire period, it could be for 1 month, up to 5 years. Where are the criteria? How does the magistrate decide? And there are no criteria. Now, judicial, we say under the circumstances, and that all the 86 is under the circumstances. That is a an assessment that the magistrate is called upon doing in respect of all the other facts. See, so this doesn't depart from an exercise that a specific section of the act requires the magistrate to conduct. You will see the container may under both the following orders, and one in rearranging the obligations. So how does the magistrate decide in where the criteria for him to decide to take a 1 year date and stretch it into a 20-year date? He needs to look at the circumstance. And where does he find the criteria? In the act. There is an extensive objective section in the act which lists all the objectives, and those are the objectives which inform and direct the discretion of the magistrate. Now, on 37, there must be clarity. Yes. Yeah, these comments are all the same. There is nothing new, so I was going to... Yeah, okay, so I'll move to the next one, yes. MKL. MKL stands for Professor M. Kelly Liu, and the M stands for M. So I'm not sure what M stands for. But he brings forward his credentials as the person who... advised, I don't know whether the committee or the DTI in the drafting of the act in the first place, and he claimed a great deal of expertise and paternity about all the provisions of the act as sustained. And the first criticism is a close one, is confusing because there is no definition of business-to-business transaction. And actually there is, because it is within the very amendment. It says when goods or services are not acquired by people who consume them. So if you acquire them to consume them for your own use, it's not a business to business. When you acquire them to do something else with them, as part of your business, on sale them, for instance, it's a business to business transaction. It's a criterion which is used also in tax law, in respect of what is part of your business and what is stock and trade. Then the next comment is all juristic persons should not be excluded. This is not what the bill does. The bill doesn't deal with excluding juristic person or juristic person. It deals with transactions, whoever the transactions are carried by. So it's the nature of the transaction. If it is a business-to-business transaction and it's attached to an incidental trade agreement, that is taken out of the bill. Then, with respect to clause 2, says, courts address the problem by declaring vending reckless. Now, this is interesting because what he's suggesting here is the courts are not faced with a situation where it's not fine, where the burden is too great, they just declare the credit reckless. Now, that's not what they should do. Reckless lending is when the bank should have not given it. Here we are not dealing with that situation. We are dealing with a situation where the lending was not reckless, but somehow the person can no longer carry the burden. He lost his job, been retrenched, the business went down, put under, and many, many people are in that condition now. So it is implicitly in the comment, there is a recognition that the amendment is meritorious because he thinks that the courts can already address it, and they are addressing, but they shouldn't. Then the final comment is about the accrual of interest, which has been raised by other people, and they read the bill as the accrual of interest. Means that they are suspended, they don't accrue, and then they are paid afterward. The accrual of interest to me and to others who read this bill means that interest is not occurring, is not happening, and does not mature. If the committee wishes to, on the advice of Andrew van der Merwe or others, change the word accrual with the word maturing or occurrence, for greater clarity, that would not be a problem. And then the last comment is why fixing this when there is so much more to fix, which is in much greater shape. And there the answer again is because we have the opportunity to do so here and now. Thank you, Madam Chairman.
Thank you very much. Can I just ask the
and non-control members, I heard the MKL is actually utilized by the or someone who did that exercise, Professor M. Kelly Lowe, but he's from the Department of Mercantile Law. That's where that comes from, UNISA, in this respect. Right, members, and of course I know you all have these documents. Yes. Have you got them?
Yes, sir.
Right, members, you're welcome now to engage with the Honourable Abrosini on this piece of this bill that is before us. Are there no takers? Yes, Honourable Hill Lewis.
Chair, I mean, just as a general point, you know, in the sense that Honourable Abrosini's responses are very clear and self-evident, and that if we want to change any of the wording, we can do so when the bill is discussed line to line.
Now, what concerns me per se is I went through some of the submissions myself, the full submission, not just the summarised form. And I just wanted to clarify something with the Honourable and Rossini in this regard. In particular, the one by Professor M. Kelly Lowe is that certainly he does not entirely agree, in fact, he does not agree with the current amendment, or the amendment in its current form, as I think he seeks to put it. And what he, I think, refers to in that regard is the need for a more holistic approach to the matter. And then with respect to the restructuring of debts, he also makes certain pertinent comments, in particular where he refers to the proposal to suspend interest while under debt review itself. And I think you did make some reference to that in with another submission, if you recall, Honourable Ambrosini, in that regard. And what remains uncertain, as we said in the first submission that came, how is the consumer going to be assisted? We're not certain in the five-year period that you referred to in which it is under review. And he proposes that a better solution might be rather to have the option that the interest rates may be reduced in certain circumstances at the time. Now, I'm asking you this because I think you looked at this in the first submission as well as now. Perhaps you could respond.
Yes, Madam Chairman. Actually, that was also in my point 37,
yes,
which I was going to address, and you sort of suggested for me to skip. And what they suggested, just for the benefit of the colleagues who might not have read the submission themselves as diligently as you have, Madam Chairman, the suggestion here was take one step at a time. The key is enabling the debtor to carry burden. Let's go further step of reducing the interest rate. Then if that doesn't work, then you suspend the accrual. And this was a cascade approach also suggested by TGM. And that in theory is all fine. But having a two-step approach means going back to the debt counseling, going back to the magistrate court, which are extremely overwhelmed, and legal fees, you can achieve the same thing conceptually by suspending the accrual of interest in the first place. Because if you want to, if you've got 10 years and you've got 10%, and you reduce it to 5% over 10 years, it's equal to eliminating the accrual for 5 years. And probably the math is not correct because the compound interest, but if you take it as single interest, that would be the case. So there with one action, which you can decide and shrink and extend as you wish, you achieve exactly the same purpose one time rather than before you give the second measure of relief, verifying that it cannot do it. And let us remind ourselves that the suggestion, the proposal here is not 5 years, but up to 5 years. So one can give the debtor a reprieve of a year, then 2 years, 3 years, depending on the condition. And what one wants to look at are debtors that increase their capacity of paying because they have another job, they reestablish their business. But if we look at the numbers of what is out there, of how many people are having problems, that this seems to be beneficial.
Right. If you respond to some degree to the issue raised by Honourable Hillwood.
No, I thought it was...
Right. Are there any other comments or questions that members wish to raise with respect to this?
Lord Jefferson, I am not intending to speak on a particular issue as raised in this latest submission. But Chair, I do want to again suggest that it would really be counterproductive to deal with a small amendment of this Act when we know that there is a whole bill coming back to us in the course of this year to amend the bill itself. As in its totality. And when we come to that stage, these matters that the Honourable Ambrosini is raising, so this small amendment will be dealt with at that point. It doesn't make sense of this committee to deal with the same bill twice. And I suggest that we pack it, we will take the issues further, together with the submissions that are being made by those who are responding now as we deal with the comprehensive amendment. Thank you.
Thank you very much, Honourable Kavalsa. Honourable Jane?
Thank you very much. I have a different view, Chairperson, which is that to the extent that this bill succeeds in providing immediate relief, and a remedy to those who are stuck in the corner as they are, we should proceed with it. The process, looking into the future, the process is indeterminate. We are in the middle of the beginning of an election year. I don't know how quickly we will be able to deal with this issue if you wait for the larger piece of legislation to arrive. It's too vague, it's too indeterminate, and I think what we have before us is something that's credible, and I think we should consider it next.
Thank you, Honourable James. Right. DTI?
Thank you, Honourable Chair, Honourable Members, and Members of the Public Trust. We firstly want to say that we stand by our earlier submissions as the DTI, that the policy objectives of the National Credit Act on the first proposed clause, was to extend the protection afforded in terms of that particular act to small business, regardless of the kind of credit transaction that they are entering into. If you take, for example, some of the comments that have been made, the protection of small businesses, including, I think Professor Kelly makes an example of spaza shops and small businesses. It is for that purpose that legislators deemed it fit that the minister be given the powers and the authority to issue a threshold upon which it is then said that such small businesses deserve the protection of the Act. For the simple reason, Honourable Chair, that such small businesses do not have the legal know-how, the legal ability, the legal muscle to actually challenge credit providers, or may not even have the ability to contract on an equal footing when it comes to credit agreements with credit providers if they are not protected or afforded protection in terms of this particular act. There are no intended consequences. That's what the DTI says. It said it was the initial policy objective. And as we submitted earlier, as we are currently doing the policy review, which will be finalized, in fact, it has been finalized, and the process is in place to submit it to cabinet. This issue of changing Section 1 or the definition, as it says, business-to-business transaction, it has never come up. It has never really been an issue. And we don't have a basis, even with the introduction of this particular bill, to try and have to tamper with that. But as we go ahead, once Parliament or Cabinet has granted the Department permission to consult widely, it is a matter that can be also consulted on and decided at that particular stage. There is value in that kind of consultation. Much as we, as the Department, respect the processes of this House, the processes of the Constitutional Court, which has actually allowed members to bring their own views. But we strongly feel that there will be a loss of value if this is passed without consultation. As we say, it has never come up before at any stage, but it can be attained during the broad consultation process. So we say, Madam Chair, that there are no intended consequences, and if one suspects or wants to submit that there are, there will be a process during the wider public consultation. Just a last point on the first proposed clause. We're saying that the Act is very clear in various parts. And say, for example, in Section 13, we talk about persons, which one will have to, within the context of the Act, to interpret that section to include restricted persons below that particular threshold. But it was the intention of the Act to include them. And there have been other criticism regarding the definition of what is a business transaction. And as a department, we associate with ourselves with such a statement. On the second issue, Madam Chair, the bill is crafted in such a way, the proposed amendment bill is crafted in such a way that it talks about suspension of interest. We do refer to the introducer of the bill, Honorable Ambrosini. We are no longer sure now what are we talking about, because at the last meeting of this committee, that was actually forwarded, was actually topic or sort of writing off of the interest. Nonetheless, whether it's actual suspension of the accrual of interest or totally writing off, we associate ourselves or hold the same view as those expressed by Professor Kelly, where she says that it's not clear to us how it's going to affect the consumers, the suspension of interest. And it's not clear to us how the interest of credit providers will be, how the interest of credit providers will be, and the investors to those credit providers will be affected by simply, if it's actually stopping or cancellation of interest, then the interest of credit providers must be taken into account. And this, again, is something that will come out very clear when consultations are taking place, if people want to raise such things. This is something that will become also very clear if a regulatory impact assessment is done as to how will this is a huge step, this is an enormous step, if you're going to write off the interest of credit provider or even suspend for that matter. And if you suspend it, it's also not clear how it's going to affect the consumer. So, Madam Chair, the risk of repeating myself, I think, you know, that is where the department would like to stand and to stop at this point in time and say these matters that we have addressed them before, they is a forum, much as we respect the constitutional constitution. Thank you.
Thank you very much, Mr. Patana. I would like to ask the advocate.
Thank you, Madam Chair. Good morning, Honourable Members. I think the submissions that have been received on this bill are actually of great assistance to this committee. All in all, what the submissions place before this committee, and I think most of them focus on the issue of the overall review that is currently underway versus an immediate impact that this bill could make. And I think that is where this committee needs to make a decision. I think that is what this will fall or stand on. Is it something that we need to wait for the review, or will this give immediate relief where it is needed? Now, some of the submissions indicate that they are concerned about practical implications should this bill be accepted. In the sense of that provision of credit might become more strict, there might be different terms, and that might affect consumers that are currently coping with their credit in a negative manner. So that is one of the things that has been mentioned. Something else that has been mentioned is a number of, especially the latest submissions, propose a number of alternatives to essentially the proposed suspension of interest. So that is something else that this committee needs to consider. Do we regard, because the suspension of interest and the wording and whether it's vague and so forth, that this committee can deal with when it goes through the bill, if the bill is found to be desirable, the committee can deal with this when it goes through it clause by clause. It can be easily reworded to a zero rating for that period, which makes it very clear that there is no interest. But that is not the issue. The issue that this committee needs to decide is, if we bring interest rates down to zero, is that the most acceptable way of dealing with the problem? And I think in that regard, the submissions can guide the committee. But in the end, it is a 100% policy decision. And the DDI's comment again is there will be a regulatory impact assessment with the review that is done. But on the other hand, it must be kept in mind we don't know when that review is coming. So it is not an enviable position in which the committee is, but I do think that the submissions do provide some guidance there. And there's a few things that I would just like to point out to the members, and that is, I think, the one thing, in fact, is on constitutionality. The case law that is quoted by TransCapital is not a case in point. It is a different issue that is being addressed there. In fact, two of the submissions propose that interest rate be reduced, and that is exactly what the proposed amendment is. So I do not agree that there's a constitutionality issue on that. From my side, I think in short, the biggest question for this committee is whether to wait for the review, whether it would be beneficial to proceed at this point in time, or whether proceeding at this point in time might affect that review. Because it must have an impact on the review, because there will be certain alternatives that are chosen now versus waiting for a regulatory impact assessment. So in the end, it is for this committee to decide whether the greatest good can be done now with this bill versus waiting for the review. Thank you.
Thank you very much. There are three things that I think we need for the committee. What was the purpose initially of the principal piece of legislation? What was its purpose? It is actually on, so I don't know if I'm not... Right.
Point taken.
Right. Point I was making is we need to consider what was the principle, the motivation, what was the reason behind the principle act in the first place? Why are there problems? What is the core problem that may be there? Because many of the issues that have come up, we are told that it is not a core problem per se. There are many reasons why people get into debt. We've heard this for the last 3 years. One of them may even be looking at your middle and sort of, those who can afford to, they have no intention to reduce their lifestyle on the one hand. And therefore, one can have the development of this attitude of debt, getting into debt and not saving. the equivalent internationally is the Japanese are such big savers, they are wanting you to see, you know, and we're in the other direction, I would imagine. But now there is also the issue of the small operator, the small trader, which ETI has once again brought to the fore. For stock sales and the like, for micro businesses, of which we are all concerned. Why? Because they create jobs, but they also provide immediate employment for whoever is conducting it. Now, does it address that issue as well? Secondly, the glaring issues that have come to light that one reads about in the media, it's often been the abuse of the actual legislation which exists, and not because there is no legislation. But those are, I think, very important. And I think for me, one of the important issues with respect to this is the policy issues, which we've heard are important in this regard. The reduction of interest, will this enable recovery of the debt? What does it actually mean? So we have one question has been put to us by the advocate, exactly when can we expect anything from ETI? I mean, that's what you would reasonably expect. We have it in writing, I may have the month wrong, that this would be April or May, so I'm looking at the Parliamentary Liaison Officer, Ms. Naidu.
Sir, the DTG indicated that we intend taking this to Cabinet in April. We're going to ask Cabinet to approve the publication of the bill and policy for public comment, and the process will be completed in June.
Right, that we had in writing, but I did communicate that to you earlier when the question came up about 3 weeks or 4 weeks ago. So I think it's a simple exercise for us now. We have to take a decision in terms of the desirability, which we can take tomorrow, which enables all parties to consult with their principals in the matter. I suggest you also look at you will be coming in, the submissions we have received. But I think that we are faced with an exercise of many firsts. And it would be very important that we do conduct our procedure correctly so that it isn't faltered. So we need to give the members here the opportunity to say, consult with their principals on the matter, to consider all the aspects here, and to come ready to take a decision tomorrow on the desirability. However, I would like to ask the Honourable Ambrosini to please have a final comment this morning.
Before.
Oh yes, thank you very much, the Honourable Impashlele.
Actually, I've already consulted. Well, on a serious note. Maybe escaped my attention. If we proceed with this bill, how many people will benefit? How many people are going to get relief? So I just want to know.
Unless you want to put that in officially, Honourable Vandermeer. Thank you. Honourable Ambrosini.
Thank you, Madam Chair. I'm required to answer some of the things which have been said. First of all, the issue of risk by the DTI, where we stand by our submission. And there is some confusion on the side of the DTI, I must say regretfully. Their concern, correctly, is about small business. And they make reference to the fact that in terms of the Act, businesses which are below a threshold identified by the Minister in regulations are exempted from certain chapters of the Act. and those which are small and are not are protected. That's common cause. That's accepted. The problem is in respect of the other chapters of the Act, from which businesses are not exempted. And that includes the incidental credit agreement. Now, the point that the DTI is raising is fine, but if you exclude all the businesses from incidental credit agreements, which are not for a consumer transaction, but are for a business transaction, then also small businesses will be excluded. Now, this is a new angle because they originally said in their submission, if you go back to their submission, we don't need this amendment because it is already covered. What the bill is trying to achieve, it is already covered. I feel by now we see that that is not the case. I mean, there is clarity for the submission of what has been said, that the incidental trade agreement operating for business transactions is not covered. The point that they're raising now, therefore, is different and worth listening to. That if you exclude all the business-to-business transactions, then also the small ones are going to be excluded. And that's important for the committee to consider. Let me give practical examples because they help us focusing the attention. Right now, when Pick and Pay buys million chickens from Early Bird, and Early Bird provides the financing, 30 days payment, 90 days payment, which is customary. That is covered by this act. And we all agree that it shouldn't be covered. It's not the intention to protect Early Bird when it extends credit to Pick and Pay. That's a huge company. And Pick and Pay doesn't buy the chickens to consume them. It buys them to unsell them. But when Pick and Pay buys things that he consumes in his office, pens and pencils, and not to unsell them in their office, then it is the consumer. The issue that the DTI raises, well, what about the Spencer shop? They are also buying from Early Bird the same chickens, and they may have the same terms and conditions, but we need to protect them in terms of the act. I did not understand that this is the type of protection we extend to Spencer shops or small businesses because they are acting as businesses under the same rules of businesses, and it becomes very difficult for within a trade and commerce if you are extending credit to one entity and differentiate a completely different regime for different entities. But that's one point. The second point raised by the DTI. And I cannot help myself but hearing it this way, and I apologize if my contraction is biased or wrong. But they say, this is not really your job, that's our job. We consult, we develop policies, we speak to people, let us do it, we'll take into account the stand back, we will do it. And this is quite crucial. You know, we are parliament, this is our job. And we can consult, we have consulted. If we haven't consulted enough, we can consult more. But it is not the prerogative of the executive to be the only one that can consult. Our job description is that of making law, and that's what we're doing here. Our job description in the Constitution is to enable public participation. That's what we're doing here. On the time frame, in the previous committee, I said I will eat my tie if that bill gets passed before the end of this legislature, and that's signed by the... I have to look for a chocolate eye. but it's not going to happen. But if the committee is concerned about the possibilities happening, there are a number of options. Now, the committee can deliberate and approve this bill. The committee can reject this bill. But also this committee can delay deliberations, as they've done in many bills. So it could wait until June, and if nothing happens, giving a clear message not only to the department, but also to the people on our own interest, because this is not my bill. It's a committee's bill, it's a bill published, it's a bill in the interest of those who have an interest in it. It could very well say, if by June we don't have a bill before us, we will consider it. Doesn't mean that we will pass it, but this committee will consider it full-fledged with a view to adopting if it likes it or rejecting if it doesn't like it. And that will also be a novel way, a new way for Parliament to crack its whip. If you don't act, we act. In a matter which, you see, in all the submission, everyone agrees that there are problems with the specific piece of legislation. Finally, the last question, how many people are affected? You see, it's a little difficult because it's a function of two numbers. The first number, how many people are under credit review, and they're going to go under credit review. I think we're talking about possibly a quarter of a million people. But this is a vote catcher. But that's the first number. The second number is how many of those will qualify for this benefit. And that's because it's under the circumstances. I cannot predict, I cannot say, that the death council, the magistrate, the parties, will need to determine. Obviously, if people can afford it, they should be able to carry it. It's all under the circumstances. There is a full disclosure of the requirement of all forms of income. Last comment in response to your comment, are we not giving an incentive to people to default? Unfortunately, I'm surrounded by many people who are in this process, which prompt me to do this legislation. And this is not party, this is not fun. People don't do it as a way of making more. Insolvency is much simpler. People do, at times, make a business out of insolvency. And it's a way of making money. This is a long process, and it's always under the circumstances. And it's a confrontational process. There is a debtor and there is a creditor. The creditor will be very fast in pointing out that the person doesn't deserve it. It's a judicial process. So I think we don't need to be concerned about the specific issue. Thank you, Madam Chair.
Thank you. One of my comments is that one is unemployed and two are poor. It's hardly going to assist you to give them 5 years. But we are going to take this back to our principles, politically speaking, that is, and come back. Ready to take a position. I may also add that I'm not aware that this particular committee has ever delayed its deliberations to that extent. I think we may have certainly delayed it 2 weeks before the close of Parliament, and it's a very different issue. So we have never deliberately delayed processing of legislation, because I think to delay the processing of legislation creates its own impediment to what it is that we are constitutionally required to do. So I can leave it like that. But I would like to thank you, Honourable Ambrosini, for being effectively prepared to respond to all of this, and also to facilitate the process by noting it down in writing so that we could matrix, you know, and with matrix in hand down.
And being on time.
Thank you very much.
And being on time.
Yes. And yes, of course, for being punctual. Thank you very much. Members, we are going to have a short break. I'd like to make it as short as possible. Let's say at the outset, 7 to 10. 7 minutes, preferably.
Coming, baby. Coming? Yeah.